Hello, welcome to the Torts Podcast. We're back. It's the first one of the 2021-22 academic year. It's just a casual chat with me and Professor Gauthier to kick us off, so enjoy. Okay, hi, we are recording our inaugural episode of 21-22 of the Torts Pod, or whatever we're calling it.
Unnamed Torts Podcasts.
There's a lot of cool suggestions. We'll figure it out. So I'm here. It's my great pleasure to be here with Professor Ryan Gauthier, who was my Torts buddy last year, and then he went away and left me.
Then I bailed. but I will be back with everyone in January, so this is your chance to meet my unique brand of mania I bring to Torts.
And we were just starting to chat about Ryan being here in Kamloops, visiting. So he's spending the semester in Oregon, but he's here for Thanksgiving weekend, I guess. So
it's, to get my winter tires put on, which the Canadian Border Services Agency was not buying that.
That's an elaborate way to get your winter tires put on.
Well, the winter tires are here in Kamloops, so I have to come to where the tires are. I wasn't going to haul them down with me.
All right.
But yeah, so I'm, as Katie mentioned, I'm a visiting professor down at the University of Oregon, where I'm also teaching torts, which is going to be a big theme of what we'll be talking about today.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's a torts podcast.
Exactly.
So should be. You didn't commit
perspectives on torts.
You didn't commit any torts on the way up here, did you? Not that you know of.
Oh, I'm just thinking of driving through Seattle and all the various near misses. I drove very much the standard of reasonable care as I understood
it. Okay, so not a tort.
A tort, although you wonder, right? It's the standard of reasonable care, and it's more prudent, but there's also in the US, we have the standard of the reasonable care in the circumstances. And I'm wondering if driving in the circumstances is really driving at 90 miles an hour at 10 p.m. So it's in the circumstances, as opposed to a speed limit. So those are the things that go through my brain.
Interesting questions about the standard of care and its interaction with statutes.
Yes.
Saskatchewan wheat pool kind of questions.
Absolutely.
Anyway, but all this is my students have just done nuisance, so we haven't even started negligence yet.
We just finished up negligence this week.
Oh, wow. You guys are fast.
Yeah, we just have damages left. But also we start in the middle of October.
Right.
Or sorry, the middle of August.
Right, so you're a couple of weeks
ahead. And we do 4 hours a week. Because down in the U.S., the students only take 3 classes and FLS per semester.
Okay.
But then they're done with the course.
So it's semesterized.
It's semesterized. Yeah, it's not a year long. So there's no time to let this mull over, let this sink in. If you haven't figured it out by December, that's it.
I actually like that. I'd be interested to know what students think. If I had got to be the dictator of the curriculum, we would do that with first year, because I get that it's nice to have the whole year period to get used to being a law student. But I mean, everything has trade-offs, and I like having fewer courses and just focusing on those courses. And I like that it matches up with upper year. It's just always seemed a real problem to me that everything else in your second and third year courses, everything is September to December.
Yeah.
And so any timing stuff that everyone is involved in, first year is out of sync and messes it up. So that's my perspective. Well, it's just hard for things like, if we were ever to have an intensive semester or something.
Yeah.
You've got some courses that are, the module is the first, second and third year courses, like the sort of time module is all in sync.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got a different set of courses where the time module is a whole different unit. And it's very difficult to coordinate those kinds of things. Anyway, so you had a good trip up. Did you come up this morning?
So I came up last night. I went to the Seattle Seahawks game. I may have been on TV because I was sitting right in the corner during interception by a Seahawks player.
Oh, we so caught I, like 2 minutes.
I haven't seen the clip, but I know there is a clip at least on Reddit. So I want to watch it to see if I can, because it was the only part of the game I recorded, because I just wanted to record a play to send to a friend in the UK, and that was the play I recorded, was this phenomenal interception right in the corner I was sitting in.
If you find yourself, if there's a clip of it, send it to me, and I will make sure that it goes in the podcast.
Yeah, like, I have a bookmark. I'm going to watch it when I get back to Oregon next week to see cool. if I can see myself. I'm pretty sure I can.
That's exciting. All right. Yeah. That's really
cool. Which is also funny, though, because I was literally just talking about football in my torts class on Wednesday before coming up.
Yeah.
Because someone brought up, we were talking about defenses, and they had sent me a clip. It involved the University of Oregon, and there was a fan who ran onto the field.
Uh-huh.
And a player uh-huh. broke the huddle, runs half the field, and just absolutely trucks this guy, just tackles okay. him. And they said, you know, I am sure this is a tort. I'm like, yes, it's yes. the tort of battery. We haven't yeah. gotten to that yet, but yes. But it might also be negligence of the stadium, of the team, and we uh-huh. can go through that. So we use that. But we also talked about the defenses.
Yeah.
Was the fan running onto the field? Was it assumption of risk yeah, or was it contributory negligence? Yeah. So that was the last thing I spoke to about my torts class before hitting the road up here. So so the takeaway from this is torts is everywhere. And that's why this course is so interesting and important.
It really is. It really is. I was preparing for this. We haven't done this for a while. I'm rusty at it. And we have these little segments that we sort of very loosely organize it around. And one of them is torts in the news. And I was kind of like, oh, I used to be very attuned to torts in the news because mm-hmm. we were doing the podcast regularly. And I would notice stuff and be like, oh, yeah. we should talk about that. And I kind of hadn't thought about it for a while. And I started trying to sort of look through news stories. And I was like, you know, they really are everywhere. Torts really are everywhere. There's
all,
stuff
all of the time.
Happening all the time. Maybe should we go to torts in the news?
Let's go to torts. Let's see what you got. Yeah.
That's a good segue. So my tort in the news, there were a couple of contenders, but the last kind of week or so, I saw these stories coming out about the Indian residential schools settlement agreement. And the gist of the stories, and I'm not an expert in this. I mean, I haven't, you know, there's a lot of history and detail there that I am not really familiar with. But the gist of the stories was the Catholic churches. There's a very complicated thing going on there because the Catholic, the main Catholic Church itself has sort of dissociated itself from the individual dioceses that mm-hmm. were involved. And then they formed a corporation that was specially formed for the purpose of these settlement negotiations. And it's all like really complicated. But anyway, the entity that represented the Catholic churches signed onto this settlement agreement. And we are, you know, we haven't really talked about settlement except in passing yet, but I know a couple of students have come in and asked me about some details about how that works. And so you know that essentially the bargain in a settlement is that you receive a release of claims. You're let off by the people who have a cause of action or may have a cause of action against you in exchange for typically paying money. Mm-hmm. But in this case, it was more complicated than that, and there were other sort of restorative justice kind of things that the church was supposed to be doing. And the problem is that they didn't do them. And one of the commitments was to provide in lieu of money, so there were money payments, but there was also in lieu of money in-kind services to sort of support Indigenous communities and people. This investigative reporting kind of showed up that what they really did was they just continued doing what they were doing anyway. So basically spreading their message, evangelizing Indigenous communities, which it occurred to me is not only something that they would have done anyway, but it's also kind of what they were doing that resulted in the residential school tragedy.
Yeah, it seems very contrary, you know, to the spirit of the settlement, if nothing
really
else, which
does.
I know is not really a thing, but it does strike me as sort of,
well, it
like
seems
you said.
Like they didn't, the Indigenous plaintiffs didn't get anything and the Catholic Church didn't give up anything. And what was interesting to me about this, thinking about it from the point of view of like settlement and its role in the process of civil litigation, civil justice and torts, is settlements are a contract and there's a real sort of art in drafting contracts, and especially when it's something complex like this. There's a really good article in the National Post, which I will post, by someone who was involved in this, who I think is a lawyer. I mean, I took it from his writing that he was a lawyer. And he said it was a terrible contract because it, for example, had no consequences for if commitments weren't complied with. So the church was supposed to make these payments, and they just sort of slowed down to a trickle. And it was kind of like there was nothing that could be done. And another part of this whole story that just seems like just frankly negligence on someone's part is that the church received a complete release of all the claims that got litigated, and a court confirmed, yes, you are completely released. So there was nothing sort of left residual, like they can't be sued now. They've been released. The federal government, which was party to this, tried to sue them and it didn't work. So I guess it's kind of like a lesson of like what not to do in settlements, and also that a settlement is, we may tell the story, okay, this case settled and the plaintiff got something, but there's a lot beneath or beyond that story potentially. Mm-hmm. Also the case when you win and get a judgment, sometimes you don't actually get anything because the defendant doesn't pay. So from a sort of like practical and human point of view, those are important things to think about. So that's my thoughts in the news.
Yeah, well, and I don't have anything in the news on that regard because it's, I'm in the U.S., which is kind of, you know, a tort in and of itself. to any American students. You can come.
We should discuss that.
Send your hate mail to me at argotia@tru.ca.
Which tort is it? That's an interesting question. Is it nuisance?
But it's actually interesting that this the Indigenous settlements is sort of becoming a thing again, because that's actually going to be my topic on Monday when I get back. On Monday it is Indigenous Peoples Day in Oregon, and it's the first Indigenous Peoples Day in Oregon, what used to be known as Columbus Day. So they've now made it Indigenous Peoples Day, and it's just, it worked out that I was planning a session to talk about the residential schools in Canada, just more as a, I have what I call topics and torts, and I have three sessions. I'm going to do the residential schools, I'm going to do concussions in the National Football League, and I'm going to do a session on climate change at the end, just to give everyone that nice bit of existential dread before we go into the exams.
Good stuff.
So again, with all this being very live, it's actually very timely that I'll be talking with the students about that, but I'm also getting the what they call down there Indian law, but it's, you know, Indigenous law. Their expert at the University of Oregon is also going to come attend my class and sort of give the American perspective.
Yeah. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah. So they're also writing a midterm next Wednesday. So sort of my breather before I run them through the midterm.
Yeah. And there were residential schools in the U.S. I was reading, in the summer, made my goal, my ambition, to read the entire Truth and Reconciliation report, which was a ridiculous goal, which I did not meet.
Yeah.
It's enormous. But I did make it through like half the first volume, which is the history one. And it's pretty fascinating. Like there were residential schools very similar to ours in the US, and they were kind of, there was a model, there was like a British Empire model that they used with Indigenous kids in like African colonies and stuff too.
My goodness.
So yeah, it's, the history is really fascinating, and one day I'll finish reading it. It's very interesting. So I have a weird tort facts thing.
Please hit me with your weird tort facts. I have a funny tort story. I have two funny tort stories that I had to tell that my class actually again this week.
I only call it weird tort facts because it's WTF.
That's true. So there's two cases that were vaguely relevant to our discussion of defenses, but there were much better cases in the case books. We go through that. But there are two cases that I saw in some extra reading I did. So one was on assumption of the risk, and assumption of the risk. So we in the US it's express and implied. And you know, to show implied assumption of the risk, one of the things that needs to be done is that it needs to be voluntary. That's one of the three elements. And so this case was in 1922 plus minus. And so this lady, she ends up using an outhouse and falls through the outhouse.
Oh my God.
Into the effluent below the outhouse. And oh so the owners of the outhouse said she assumed the risk. And the court said, no, she didn't assume the risk. She was faced with the call of nature.
Right.
She didn't have a meaningful choice. It's not voluntary.
You can't choose not to go.
So there was exactly that was the judgment of the court.
Oh my God.
So that's my one funny story. The other one, this was about express assumption of the risk, but I haven't read the entire judgment, so I don't quite know why. All I know, this is a case in the 1980s in upstate New York. And it involved donkey basketball.
Were they playing or being used as basketballs?
So I understand they were riding the donkeys.
Oh my
that's
God.
As far as that's. But the court doesn't explain what donkey basketball is in the judgment. I feel like that's a big hole in the court's reasoning. But
did you like Google it? Is there anything?
I tried to. I couldn't really find it. I'm going to spend some more time on this.
It's but, also an animal law topic.
So. It is an animal law topic and a sports law topic, so it fits all of our interests. But the court said that there was an express assumption of the risk by playing donkey basketball. There doesn't seem to be a waiver, but I guess the risk was so obvious and apparent that if you're riding a donkey playing basketball, you could fall over and hit your head. They just said it doesn't fit
how
in with everything else.
How did you find this?
This was in a footnote of a of sort of some supplementary material I used to supplement my lectures. It was just a footnote, but the words donkey basketball jumped off the page at me.
It's like a lure.
Oh,
how can you not go after that?
Isn't this the best part of torts? Is the wacky facts?
Yeah, it is. Torts is full of...
Show me donkeys playing basketball and property.
Yeah, it's just full of, like, crazy people.
People
doing
are
crazy
weird.
Things.
Like, that's the thing to take away from this.
Yep, it's so true. It's so true. Mine is not as fun as that. My weird tort fact is I discovered that there's an American Tort Law Museum or American Museum of Torts or something.
And where is it located?
In New York, I think.
Naturally.
I will check. But it was started by Ralph Nader. And I don't know, our students might be too young to know who
I
Ralph
think they're
going to
be
Nader
because
is.
Now Ralph Nader was the 2000 election where
that's
he
right.
really came yeah. into prominence. So if you weren't.
Well, he was prominent as a public interest
yes.
lawyer before
yes,
that.
He had
like
been.
Going back to the 70s, he was an
yes.
advisor to Jimmy Carter.
Yes.
And he was. And also he started all the public interest research groups. So when I was in university, yep. which was 1,000 years ago, he was like quite prominent for this public interest group movement.
Yep.
That was in the 90s. Before that, sort of going back to the 70s, he was very prominent for like basically starting with the auto industry, kind of like holding them to account for having unsafe
yeah.
stuff. So he was very... He sued people,
yes.
But he also advocated for changes in public policy, like seatbelt laws coming in. And then, so he was sort of a hero in the 90s, and then he ran in the 2000 election, and he's basically the reason why George W. Bush got elected, and then he was a bit less of a hero.
Pretty much. That's a good summary.
Yeah, anyway. So the American Museum of Tort Law, I will put a link to it in on our webpage for the podcast.
So it's a virtual tour, I notice.
Yeah, so it is a physical place, and I think it's in New York somewhere. It will tell us somewhere in here. But they had to close down the physical exhibits because of COVID. So they actually put like all the exhibits online, and it's pretty good. You can go in and sort of poke around. It's got like a little video.
Oh,
Ralph
that is
Nader
fantastic.
Explains tort law. It's actually really cool. Like it's educational if you want to think about. We have to get into the nitty gritty of what are the tests and what are the,
yeah.
you know, these very, and like the philosophical foundations and these very kind of like academic points about tort law. But this is a very interesting way to kind of zoom back and think about kind of like what does it mean in...
Well, it's the why of tort law. It's the
why
purposes.
Of tort law, the way that it can be used as a... I mean,
yeah.
Nader really, this museum really frames it as like a weapon in the hands of the little guy to poke the big corporations with. And it can be. I don't think that's all that it is, but...
Yeah, well, you have the phrase in the U.S., private attorneys general is something,
yeah.
is one of the few things I remember from my 1L torts class. And yeah, it's the idea that the private person can hold big corporations
right.
or, in some circumstances, the government to account through tort law in a way that you would normally expect an attorney general
yeah.
to do on behalf of the government.
And to me, like, that raises all sorts of questions about, like, is that an intelligent way to hold corporations to account, right? Like, why do we leave it to individuals to be private attorneys general and not have, like, regulation? Those are interesting questions. And I think that this, if you take a look at it, it's pretty fun, and it might, like, maybe stimulate some thinking about those things. It's got exhibits that are about sort of famous tort stuff, negligent stuff, product liability things, like the Ford Pinto, the famous exploding car, and the McDonald's hot coffee, which we cover in class. Dangerous toys. It's got a whole exhibit on, like, lawn darts and toys
that cause
children to lose limbs and stuff. So, again, returning to the theme of, you know, crazy, wacky, weird things that people do that are dangerous.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's my weird tort fact. The American Museum of Tort Law exists. And actually, how I found out about that was I saw some random thing, possibly on Twitter, from someone who was a tort professor who donated his lawn darts to the American Museum of Tort Law, and they accepted it, and he was all happy and excited.
Why a tort law professor owns lawn darts raises some interesting ethical questions.
I'm guessing that he owned them to bring them to class and show them to students as an example of something dangerous. So
I just throw a book around when I need a blunt object.
So there you go. A weird tort fact. So the rest of our plan for this was really just for me to ask Ryan what it's like teaching torts in the US and how's that compared to teaching it here?
Yeah, absolutely. And we talked about already how torts is one semester and it's 4 hours a week. So it's a little bit more focused. The other two courses my section is taking right now, I'm in the yellow section as opposed to the green section. That's the colors of the University of Oregon. So they're taking torts, they're taking civil procedure, and they're taking contracts in addition to FLS. So civil procedure is sort of one of the bigger differences. And that brings me to probably my first thing that I thought of that is very, very different between there and here is in the US, most of the cases are appeals of either summary judgments or jury verdicts, both of which are really hard to deal with because, and it requires a bit of knowledge of civil procedure.
Yeah. And civil procedure in the US is crazy.
It is, and the reliance on civil juries is bananas. But so I spend.
And we do have them here in BC. We have civil juries, although
not for long.
They've been we don't have them because they've been suspended.
And they have been suspended for COVID, but the BC Law Institute put out a report recommending their elimination, and the Attorney General's taken that under advisement, and they're doing consulting. So you might not have them anymore.
I wouldn't be surprised.
And I would be shocked.
It's interesting, like, if you guys do have a look at the American Museum of Tort Law, like, the point of view of plaintiff side lawyer people like Ralph Nader is civil juries are the best thing. Because they're like
the voice of the people. If you're plaintiff 100%, 100%. And it's interesting talking about that, and we're just going to be doing damages in 2 weeks. And I'm happy to talk about damage because that's very different.
Damages.
But I want to talk. I just want to spend another minute on this whole jury thing. So all of the appellate decisions, almost all of the time at the end of the appellate decision is whether or not this is a question that can go to the jury or not.
Right.
That's all they're asking is this: could this have withstood a motion for summary judgment, which meant that the claim was so obvious, either that it obviously had no merit or is obviously meritorious that it can then go ahead. Or is this a claim that there's either a dispute in fact, or it's the type of question that goes to a jury? And the interesting thing is what they determine to be a question of law and a question of facts, because duty is a question of law. It gets answered by a judge, but by its proximate cause, it's generally a question of policy, but that goes to a jury.
That's weird.
It's so weird.
And also because duty and proximate cause, like,
are
honestly,
so similar.
You can't tell the difference sometimes.
No, we went through Paul's graph this week for proximate cause, but we use that up here for duty. And the students are like, but this is duty. I'm like, well, yes, it is, but here's the twist and here's why it matters. So the involvement of juries makes reading the cases a bit more of an adventure, and the sort of procedural background gets kind of wackier as a result. So that's one of the differences. And the other one, which you wanted to jump on, is damages. So, you know, just like up here, we have compensatory damages. Okay, fine. You know, lost wages, medical bills are a much bigger thing down there. And
it's out of pocket.
Question yeah. I got in the first week, what about insurance companies?
Yeah.
You know, does the insurance company, you know, do they get the money? How do they do that? So I had to go learn that so I could explain.
And that's an issue here, too. Like a lot of tort cases are actually like between insurance companies, really.
Exactly. So, you know, we have the medical bills, you know, pain and suffering. There's some differences in the details, but the basics are the same. The big difference is in punitive damages. Mm-hmm. And as you're going to learn, there's a cap on punitive damages in Canada. It's about $400,000 these days. In the U.S., it's whatever the jury decides, mm-hmm. although it's gone up to the Supreme Court of the United States, which is weird how a tort case even gets to the Supreme Court of the United States, because there's no federal common law. It's all state.
Right.
So I'll get to that in a sec, because that's the third thing I want to bring up, is dealing with 50 plus different jurisdictions.
Yeah, plus the federal stuff. Exactly. That's it.
So there's crazy. No federal common law. However, the U.S. Supreme Court hears cases involving admiralty. So there's a lot of wacky boat cases, including U.S. Carroll Towing, that get heard by the federal courts, not the state courts.
What about diversity jurisdiction? That's federal
they do hear diversity jurisdiction, but like you said, yeah, the federal courts apply state law.
See, I worked in the U.S. I learned like 5% of their fucking crazy, ooh, I swore in the podcast, am I?
But yeah, no, I mean, diversity jurisdiction is its own absolute abhorrent nightmare. That's my first year moot. I have a story. Well, later podcast, we'll talk about mooting and my first year moot traumatic experience. Because it's all diversity jurisdiction. But so the Supreme Court ruled on the constitutionality of damages, of punitive damages. Whether it violated the due process, I think it was. And they said something like if punitive damages was more than like three times compensatory damages, uh-huh. or whatever, they came with some ratio. But then they said, we're not going to really apply the ratio. It's all a bit of a mess. I still have to unpack it. So there's that. But what a lot of states have done is they've put in legislation to cap punitive damages. In some cases, to cap even compensatory damages, if they're against the state. But those have been struck down in some cases. I'm wrangling through a recent Oregon judgment mm-hmm. that they struck down punitive damages in some regards, but upheld them in other regards. And now it looks like they're re-upholding them. It's this like series of four cases over 20 years
crazy.
Where they're wrestling whether or not a cap on punitive damages violates a person's constitutional rights.
And tort law is so political in the U.S.
It really is. There's a case we did, and we're going to do the DES cases when we talk about market share liability in a couple of weeks up here. We do similar cases down there. It's the same case, just different actual pockets of litigation. The Wisconsin courts actually applied market share liability in a case involving lead paint. Mm-hmm. And they said, we're going to apply it. And so the plaintiffs are going to get their money. And all the judges got voted out. And the Wisconsin legislature uh-huh. legislated that away.
Wow.
So you're right. It is political down there.
Yeah. Much more than here. I mean, those kinds of struggles about, like, you know, how much does government want to shield itself? And how much does government want to shield or make open to liability sort of corporations that have done important things.
Yeah, I mean, government's we have kind that of here, hands off same. In so many ways compared
not
to
the same extent as that.
And so that brings me to the third thing I want to quickly mention is the reality of dealing with 50 jurisdictions.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, up here, yes, we do have
it's complicated.
We do have, oh, you know, God. Of course, our different provincial jurisdictions. Yeah. And there's sometimes differences in the details. You know, Ontario might go mm-hmm. one way, BC might go another way. We see this, for instance, with employment law all the time. Ontario goes one way, BC goes the other. Okay, fine. But there's usually only one, two, maybe three directions at most that the provinces are going in.
Yeah. And then also, if it's common law, the Supreme Court can set a uniform rule.
Absolutely,
right?
So, which solves the problem.
Yeah.
But it's not the case with tort law in the U.S. because mm-hmm. there is no federal common law. And so it's 50 different jurisdictions making 50 different determinations. Now, there's usually sort of majority and minority, but even talking about defenses and who uses contributory negligence.
Right.
There are five jurisdictions that use contributory negligence. Who uses comparative fault? Well, if we're talking 50% plus one, there's 20. If we're talking 50% or greater, it's 17. And there, South Dakota does their own weird, unique thing. So
I'm tired just listening.
Yeah. So a lot of answers.
Do you have to deal like just with Oregon? Like, do you?
Every now and then I try to bring in some Oregon relevant stuff. So this idea of Oregon capping its punitive damages. I was reading about punitive damages. Some states have capped. I said, what's going on in Oregon? How weird can it be? Then I forgot Portland's slogan, which is keep Portland weird.
Uh-huh.
Apparently that applies to the Supreme Court down in Salem, Oregon, and they have kept it weird. So I'm going to bring that in as sort of an Oregon thing because we are in Oregon.
Right.
I did that recently. There was a case. It had to do with, I think it was a proximate cause case. But it took place in Oregon. It was 1970s. There's a lady. She was wearing a fake fur coat that was highly flammable. There were some guys in this car service shop who blew some gas out of a hose. So the gas shoots across the shop.
This is like
It lands on the floor. It gets near a heater. The heater catches on fire, which catches her coat on fire. So she sues the coat manufacturer. She sues the seller of the coat. And she sues the service station. And the service station tries to make an argument. Well, if you find that the coat manufacturer and JCPenney are liable, we clearly are not. And the court says that's absolutely not how any of this works.
Yeah, that just doesn't
sound. But this got me thinking. Because in Oregon, now I drive an electric car, so I don't have to worry about gas. But in Oregon, you can't pump your own gas.
What?
Yeah. So Oregon and New Jersey, when you pull up to the gas station, an attendant comes out and pumps your gas. And so my question was, is this why Oregon has laws against that?
It's not.
No, it was passed in the 1950s.
It's a labor protection thing.
It's a little bit, yeah. So it was passed in the 1950s initially to do with like safety and stuff. And most states had this law. And nowadays, yeah, it's a little bit safety, but it's really justified, A, to keep jobs, and B, and this is an interesting one, this is an interesting justification that never came to my mind, the idea that it's equitable, because if someone has a disability or someone is a senior, they may not be able to pump their own gas, so they'd have to go around looking for a full service station, but if every station is full service, then those people don't have to worry about
like
that.
How much of a burden is it to say, hey, is there an attendant?
But if there's no full service stations, because I can't think of many full service stations in Kamloops. I know there's one at River Shore, but now I'm not saying it's driving
but
bus.
You could solve that one by saying every gas station has to have the
one
ability
attendant,
to,
or
you don't have to say you're never allowed. Don't touch.
No,
the pump.
No. I do think there's
nobody can touch
that
pump.
So I did look into that. I'm like, why does Oregon? And it turns out some gas stations you are allowed to serve yourself, but it's in rural counties. It's up to them. And it's overnight. So they don't have to have someone manning a station in the middle of nowhere, Oregon, at 2 a.m. So I do bring some Oregon law in if it's sort of interesting or relevant, but it's absolutely not the focus. And it is the same when I went to law school. It wasn't focused on Massachusetts law. We kind of learn, like, here's what the majority of states do, but sometimes there's a minority. We talked about suing governments. So governments generally have a fair amount of immunity, but they've legislated it away. So I took a look at Oregon. Oregon was pretty much, you can sue us. There's a limit on damages you can get, and there's some things you can't sue us for. Pretty normal. Tennessee was, we're creating our own tribunal, and you can only sue the government in this specialized tribunal in Tennessee. So again, 50 different states, 50 different ways, potentially different ways of doing things. And then there's DC, Puerto Rico, et cetera.
Right.
But it does make it a challenge sometimes, because I'll have students who go, well, what is this here? And I'm like, depends on the jurisdiction. I don't know.
Wow.
So that's a little challenging to teach.
Yeah. That sounds really complicated, and I feel sort of grateful that, here, there are some differences, but most of the time we can pretty much say, like, this is what the law is in Canada. Like, you pretty much got, you know, like,
and the difference is like a little bit here, a little bit there. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So
you're not going to get some totally different test for nuisance in Manitoba than you will in British Columbia. But in the US, it's like the test for nuisance in New York can be totally different than the test in California. Who knows?
I saw that from looking at that, the pig CAFO case from North Carolina, which I've mentioned in class a couple of times. And in North Carolina, they changed like the common law nuisance rules by statute in various ways. For example, coming to the nuisance as a defense in North Carolina. And they had like some special rules for like the particular area of North Carolina where all of these pig farms were, because they were protecting the pig concentrated farming industry. So yeah, all these sort of specific kind of idiosyncrasies of policy that have to do with who's powerful in that state. And it's pretty interesting stuff, but kind of exhausting. So I'm glad that I don't have to deal with that.
it's a little bit much sometimes. And I know the answer of it depends on the jurisdiction is not always one that's accepted, but it's frankly the reality. I can be like, here is, and to complicate matters a little bit further, and you'll remember this, we have the restatements.
Oh yeah, and and what about the uniform law people? That is the restatement.
That
right?
is the restatement.
The restatements.
Yeah,
right.
So
yeah,
so that thing. The restatements are a. It's a book or it's a report. Right.
It's like a civil code.
It's like a civil code in a sense.
But it's not the law.
It's a bunch of law professors who get together and who say, we think this is either what the law is because we have 50 plus jurisdictions to wrangle. And they try to go, here's what we think this is, looking at the other 50. But sometimes it's here's what we think it should be.
Right.
And so there's been three editions of the restatements. The first one came out in like 1940 something. The second one came out in the 1970s. The third one came out like 10, 15 years ago. So they only come out like every 30 years. So it's a big deal when a new restatement comes out. But the restatements will sometimes disagree with each other, and courts will disagree with the restatements.
Right.
So I'm going through the textbook and it'll be like, here's the rule. And the second restatement states the rule and everyone's on board with it, but the third restatement's trying to change it. Okay, makes sense. But sometimes it's the second restatement said this, the third restatement says this, they conflict with each other, half the court's like this, half the court's like that. And so now you're not only dealing with the various jurisdictions, even the people who are trying to make the law more uniform disagree across restatements. And so you're trying to sit there, and you'll have a court in 2021 going, no, we prefer the second restatement from 1974, so that's what we're doing. And it's just like,
That's a lot.
Okay.
I feel like you've sort of given me a gift here, because if my students complain that things are too complicated or they don't like that there's an ambiguity or two different approaches, I can just be like, well, you could be in the States. You should be grateful. Yeah. So stop.
They think about those poor kids in America.
Exactly.
What they have to go through.
Exactly. So
they have to deal with juries and jurisdictions and
restatements.
Yeah. But to be honest, most of the basic concepts are pretty samey.
Yeah.
A negligence claim is duty, breach, cause in fact, proximate cause, although the third restatement is pushing this the phrase scope of liability. I hated it at first. I kind of like it more because I think it makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, it's just a less old-fashioned way of saying it.
It is. But it makes more conceptual sense,
but
too.
But scope of liability is duty as well.
Right? But it is duty, exactly.
Yeah, so once again, very hard to tell the difference between those two. Not convinced there really is one.
No, and the more I go into the less I am kind of convinced as well.
Still
not
100% convinced.
Yeah, especially because, a lot of proximate cause, so I mentioned to students, I'm like, okay, so if there's a proximate cause question, we have to think of, is there a foreseeable plaintiff? Is there a foreseeable consequence? And then there's something else, I can't remember what it was. One of my students comes up to me, well, isn't foreseeable plaintiff duty? It's like, well, yes, but also courts, depending on the jurisdiction, have said we just presume a duty. So we don't even consider foreseeability of the plaintiff. We just presume it is. But it is duty.
Yeah.
Like it is the thing. And after that conversation, like this is.
Yeah, they're kind of similar.
Duty.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, all you're really doing with proximate cause is eliminating freak accidents, which is kind of why I like scope of liability. Yep. Although I think it just be, is this a freak accident? And although that's not very legal terms, but that's more accurate.
That's what it's trying to get at. And that's it is, I think it's helpful to sort of like get out of the legal jargon sometimes and think like, why does this rule exist?
Well, and, yeah, and that's,
because if you do something wrong, you slip up, you're liable for some stuff, but not the really crazy stuff that exactly. just happened to follow from that because it was freakish. Yeah.
Yeah. And being, you know, that we've just gotten through negligence, I just finally went through the purposes of tort law this week.
Yeah.
Because I think it was a good time to do so. Because again, in the textbook down there, it's like, you know, page 10, what are the purposes of tort law? And they're like, I don't know what a tort is. I'm like, yeah, see, we can't tell you the why before you get the what. So now that they've seen...
makes, you know, very little sense.
Exactly. Yeah. So now that they've seen 100 negligence cases in various forms, now I can go through some of those big picture, you know, look, we're talking about compensation, we're talking about deterrence, we're talking about fairness. Mm-hmm. It's good to step back with that.
I learned torts at the University of Toronto, which has a very specific philosophical orientation to torts. And I was raised to believe, and it really was something approaching a religion, that the purpose of tort law is to be itself. So my professors at the University of Toronto were like highly allergic to the idea that it has any external purpose.
It just expresses
something about tortness, and that's what it's for.
That's an opinion.
So there you go. This has shaped my thinking about tort law.
Yeah.
And where I think they have a point is when you look at any of the external purposes, it's only partially good at doing them, right?
So oh, 100%.
As a compensation mechanism, it's kind of like, it's kind of awesome for the specific plaintiff who gets very specifically compensated for the thing that happened to them. But if the purpose of this thing in the world is to compensate people who suffer from injuries, yep. it's terrible at it.
Oh, because absolutely.
You don't get compensated for all kinds of injuries where
yep.
there wasn't a duty of care yep. or it was,
it was, meant, was contributory negligence. It wasn't a recognized injury.
Or, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You don't have enough proof of it. And which is why...
Well, and to get compensated, you have to spend thousands of yep. dollars on lawyer's
you
fees.
You lose like a third of your compensation.
It takes a lot of time. Yep. And again, something we're going to be talking about, damages. Part of the reason punitive damages are so high, or part of the reason damages for pain and suffering are so high, are really to cover lawyer's fees.
Yep.
And people talk about this like, this is a good thing. We have fixed the system. Like... No, but you're papering over
it's
the
like
problem.
One problem kind of made to fix a different problem, made to yeah. fix a different problem. Like many human institutions.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very bizarre Jenga tower.
It really is. It really is. So, yeah, the purpose of tort law is to be itself is just one way of solving that whole problem.
Yeah, well, I'm even going through the purposes of tort law in my class, and that's one of the reasons I want to go through these topics of torts is to go... Does tort live up to these? Like, if we're talking yeah. about tort law and climate change, and maybe that's a future thing we can talk about on a podcast, is going
yeah,
to happen.
Yeah, we should. Yeah,
we should. But that's the reason I want to bring up, you know, the concussions or climate change or the residential school settlements and 6C scoop is, does the tort system deal with deterrence? Does it actually deal mm-hmm. with compensation? But then the question is, if it doesn't work, then what do we replace it with? You know, I think in Canada with, you know, whether it's the Civil Resolution Tribunal or some things have come out of the residential school settlements, there have been some positive, mm-hmm. you know, creative things that have come out of settlements. I think there's maybe hints or ideas of a way forward.
Well, in BC, we replaced it completely for auto accidents
yeah.
like less than a year ago.
Yeah, with no fault.
With no fault car insurance, which is what I think most of the provinces do. And, we had really interesting discussions with students last year about the pros and cons of that. But as a mechanism for compensation, I think it's better. It will be worse for a small subset of people who, with very specific types of injury, who could have yep. got higher compensation awards. But for
most
the vast
people,
majority
most
of
the
people,
time,
it's just
they'll probably get compensated faster.
Yeah, and where they honestly probably wouldn't have at all under a tort system because
yeah.
it wasn't worth it.
It's, you know, on the one hand, and the trial lawyers are very much up in arms over this.
Oh yeah, it's bad for trial
lawyers. Because you know, they say, no, well, people question. Need lawyers.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, of course, I'm sympathetic towards the trial lawyers. On the other hand, if a law system is so complicated that you know, again, there are things you need lawyers and law is complicated.
And you're allowed to have a lawyer in the civil resolution tribunal for non-fault auto stuff. It's just that it's not worth it because the lawyers are really expensive, and most the vast volume of that stuff is relatively small compensation awards to people who got injuries that they need compensation for, but they're not big enough numbers to pay a lawyer out of. So, I mean, I find that, like, I find it troubling that lawyers think there's a justice argument there. It's like, yeah, they need lawyers. So, you know, no one's stopping you. Be their lawyer.
Like,
oh, well, I won't get paid enough. Oh, well, what's the problem then?
And... you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, most of these things, you know, they settle or they're pretty clear and things like that, which is why I'm also doing a settlement exercise down south as well. I'm just going to borrow what we did last year.
Excellent.
I thought it went so well. I mean, we had a unit on, the person taught before me has a whole unit on products liability.
Yeah.
Which is very, it's a little bit unique in the U.S., but it's not so... whatever, it's negligence, but turned up.
Well,
to
there's
11.
some strict liability.
There's some strict liability stuff, but I figured it'd be better to go through sort of the settlement exercise stuff because that's the reality of a lot of what is going on. Everyone thinks I'm going to have my day in court. I'm going to convince the judge that I'm worth this, and 97 or 98% of the time, there will be a settlement. Yeah.
And the day in court is not what people think it is when they think that. It's not like everyone listened to my story and I there's applause.
even if you think the tort system is to get your day in court, it doesn't even do that.
Nope. Yeah. Well, I guess we should wind it up. I think we were aiming to do a fairly short episode for our first one, right?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
You know, and again, I mean, you know, because this is really meant to be sort of extra. I know there's some things we've talked about today because, you know, they make a lot of sense to us because we've taught this now together for a year, but you might go, I don't quite know what that's about,
what
but that's okay.
About?
Because you're going to learn this over the next couple of actually here the whole year.
Yeah.
Because we're done. I told my class, I'm like, we're 70% done all our material. All we have left is damages, intentional torts, and nuisance. And then the rest is settlement exercise topics and torts review.
Yeah.
Other stuff.
So you guys are way ahead of.
Yeah. So that's why all of this is on my mind. Whereas when I come back, I'll be talking about damages again in January. But it's also good to maybe be exposed to some of this in advance, and then when you run into it and you kind of go, oh, okay, well that's why this is interesting. That's why this matters. And I also think it's important. You know, it's one thing I think for Professor Sykes and I to bang out a little bit about the tort system. And to be critical of it. And it's good to be critical of these things, but it's also good to understand something before being critical of it.
And there's a lot to understand. It's complicated and big and...
Exactly. So, I mean, you know, to jump in on and say, you know, no-fault auto is the best or it's the worst. Well, you know, you have to understand how it works and you have to understand what it's replacing.
Exactly.
Right. That's the important thing because a lot of people in the media, it's like, well, here's what it is, and here's why it's terrible because it's one case. And it's like, no. But you have this current system, and it's replacing it. And on that, you have to assess whether it's good or bad. And I'm not saying it's perfect. No fault. I'm more of a defender than not. Not saying it's perfect. I'm not even going to say there's not any problems.
Everything has pros and cons. Everything has trade-offs.
But yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you have to compare it to what it is. And that's sort of the theme I take with torts.
Yeah.
You talk about torts being it is what it is. I see torts a lot as balancing.
Mm-hmm.
What it's trying to do, it's
the
balancing.
The original purpose was to stop people from like beating each other up.
I did talk about that. I did mention that in my class the other day. It was to prevent people from taking the law into their own hands and you know burning someone's house down or something. Yeah. Or it was... So tort has to prevent people from doing that.
Yeah.
And has to prevent people from just like not availing the system at all. It's just trying to seek a balance between, you know, all of these things or between two parties, between what is fair and what is not. And, you know, it doesn't always get the balance right. But
I want to add a note of caution on that, though, to students, because justice, you know, the symbol of justice is a scale, is balancing. There is a great deal of weighing and balancing and balancing different factors and trying to, I think, adjust outcome in a lot of ways you can think of as a sort of a reasonable course, a non-extreme course.
Yeah.
I think at the beginning of studying law, that theme can lead students to jump to, the answer is always something in the middle, right?
So, yeah.
Who wins, the plaintiff or the defendant? Both. Yeah. And like, that actually is not a thing.
No.
Legal system. It's like, there's an awful lot of things that are on-off switches. It's like, liability or not. You can't be half liable. Like, you can't be a little bit pregnant.
Yeah.
So you have to try to develop in your mind the skill of thinking about things from a point of view of sort of reasonableness and judiciousness, but not trying to be King Solomon every time and be like,
have to you. No,
there
because,
we go,
because at the end of the day, exactly, it's the reliable or not. It complied with the legislation or it didn't. It is constitutional or is not.
And there might be arguments on both sides about that question, but that doesn't mean that the answer is half yes.
Yeah, and then when I talk about balance, it's not trying to strike this sort of balance keeping things equal, it's what is that balance?
Yeah.
And the balance is always going to tip towards one thing more or less. It's more compensation over maybe more deterrence, or it's more efficiency maybe at the cost of fairness. And, you know, it's the balancing of the plaintiff's interests, of the defendant's interests, of societal interests. But something has to win.
Yep.
Something has to to come out of the wash.
There's a winner and a loser.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And to some extent, that is fudged in things like damages, because that can be apportioned. But like, it's a binary.
Yes.
there's win or lose, and there isn't a sort of like half win, half lose, except for those like really weird cases like that Del Webb case where it's like, you get an injunction and you get damages. But that's just not okay.
No, well, there's more than U.S. because I remember I reread Boomer v. Atlantic Cement, which I hadn't read since I was in law school. I'm like, oh, they're doing the same thing here. I hate it.
Yeah, we don't like that.
No. We're very absolutist when it comes to nuisance.
We don't like that. All right. Well, I think we'll wrap it up. And for our next one, I don't know what we'll do for our next one, but at some point we're going to try to get our third tort friend, Professor Millard, to be part of this.
That might be a good December one.
She wanted to do it today and she was tied up with something else. Yep. But I really like the idea of talking to her about the South African system.
Mm-hmm.
They have delict. It's a civil system.
Yes.
And I think a lot of the basic principles are very similar, but it's a completely different system. So we will talk about that in a future episode.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And great to see you.
Take care.
Bye. Well, that's the end. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. And stay tuned. We should have more episodes coming soon.